Okay, you're listening to the Friday Morning After. I'm Joe Broadhurst, and I am pleased to be joined on the phone with Bill Conroy. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning. How are you doing, Joe?
I'm doing good. We are, Bill, you are with Narco News. You are an investigative reporter. You've been an investigative reporter for a long time. Can you give us a little bit of your background so that our listeners have an idea of what you've been doing?
Yeah, I've been doing journalism since the mid-80s, so I can't even count the years right now. Basically around the United States and northern part of the states and the southern part of the states now for the last dozen years, and really started focusing in on kind of law enforcement issues probably about 6 years ago, looking at U.S. Customs and some of the problems that were creeping up just before they created the huge Department of Homeland Security here, kind of anticipated the dysfunction that exists within these huge bureaucracies we have here.
Can you imagine? Do you know how many agencies are actually involved under that umbrella?
There were about more than 20 agencies they brought together. It was like 200,000 employees that they just suddenly rolled up overnight into one huge bureaucracy. And a lot of them had issues as individual agencies, so they just kind of multiplied the problem. But everyone was kind of in a rush, at least the politicians were here, to have a quick fix to show the people after 9/11. And I think now they're seeing that maybe the quick fix was really just a bigger problem. So and some of that is just a function of, I think, people in general, that there's a lot of fiefdoms that are created in these bureaucracies. And they're by nature competitive, and also by nature tend to be dysfunctional, because the people that get promoted to the top aren't always the best people, and then so you got a lot of leadership that really doesn't have field experience or isn't really that interested in the bigger picture. They're more interested in their own careers.
Yeah, they're political appointments, right?
I mean, some of them are. Yeah,
we saw that with Mike Brown. I mean, that was a mess.
Exactly. At the very top, they're political appointments. That's a big problem. But then there's a whole mid-tier under that. Now, this isn't necessarily every single one, but in a lot of cases, the mid-tier in some of these agencies have gotten there through means other than merit. And so then you have a lot of leadership that really isn't interested in doing good work in the field. They're interested in promoting their own careers, and so a lot of bad decisions are made. I don't know how you fix that, but that's part of the problem that I've run across covering at least Homeland Security and some of these other agencies. And that's why, as they brought them all together, it didn't really work. The problem they needed to fix was more at the mid-management level and the political appointment level individually in these agencies, and they didn't really fix that. They just kind of put it in a blender and hoped it would go away. So
you've been with Narco News for how long?
About 2 years now. I've been Narco News is a nonprofit, and we got journalists across the globe, but primarily in North and South America. And we all basically do this as a project out of the belief that we need to do some good journalism out there that's an alternative to the mainstream press, in the sense that there's no advertising and it's not driven by money or other ulterior motives that might get in the way. So, I mean, we're doing this kind of pro bono because we believe in the project and trying to get some good investigative journalism out there. And it was started to cover the drug war and democracy movements in Latin America. And I kind of came on because I'm along the border, the southern border by Mexico, started covering some of the border issues there in relation to the drug war because of the law enforcement background. And that's kind of how I fit in about 2 years ago.
And the drug war, I mean, they throw so much money at this drug war, and they have for a long time. Up here in Canada, there was special panels that stated in 1999 that this doesn't work. They continue to throw about $500 million at it up here. And mostly that money goes to local law enforcement, and who knows what they do with it. Hopefully they buy, equipment to protect themselves. But down in the U.S., I mean, we're talking about billions and billions of dollars for a long, 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 long time. And when you have that kind of money, you're going to have corruption. And so you guys down at Narco News have been discussing the corruption factor for a long time, right?
Yeah, in fact, that's really pretty much what my stories have dealt with. What I've discovered, now not everyone's going to have my take on this, so I'm not trying to preach, but this is kind of what I've discovered covering this, is that, you know, there are honest law enforcers that really want to do the job right. But, you know, they're doing what they're, you know, essentially the way the law is set up now, is you have a drug war and you've got to go after, the kids on the street and so forth. And the real problem, at least as I see it, is, you know, criminal elements are criminal elements. I mean, murder, extortion, money laundering, all that stuff, that's criminal regardless of whether it's connected to drugs or not. And that should be dealt with. I mean, nobody wants to be extorted or deal with these narco trafficking rings, which are really nothing more than elaborate, you know, capitalist organizations that are extreme in nature. I mean, they have an extreme profit motive, and their way they enforce contracts isn't through the court system, it's with a gun. But they're just a form of a corporation, really. And they operate very similar rules to any major corporation. They have to have the same kind of structures, and they have a profit motive, etc. So that's the issue. The drugs are another matter. That's the product. And how you deal with that is something that has to maybe be rethunk or rethought.
Yeah.
What happens is a lot of these law enforcers that have been in it, they start seeing some of this, and they see the corruption that sets in, and they become the whistleblowers on this. They're talking about the fact that the system has become essentially a pretense. I mean, we don't have a drug war. We have a drug war pretense. And this is across agencies that this is starting to become, relevant or at least seen. And, you know, because all the money that you're spending, and I've had this told to me, all the money that's being spent in the United States alone on the quote-unquote drug war, if they really wanted to end the drug war, they would end it. In other words, you would be able to wipe out all the poppy fields in Afghanistan overnight if you really wanted to. That isn't going to happen for a variety of reasons. Number one, it helps prop up a number of countries. The drug economy is just huge. I mean, it's incredibly huge. It's like black matter in the system. You don't see it, but it's a big percentage of the universe. And so it ain't going away as long as it's set up the way it is. That's kind of what's happened. So you've got this huge underground black economy that is rooted into the political systems of various countries, including ours, and it's rooted into, you know, so many different things, including the prison industrial complex here. And, you know, instead of being honest about that and recognizing it, we have this pretense called the drug war, and we continue fighting this endless war on the surface of this big black underground economy. And that's kind of what the best way that I've come to see it.
I don't
have the answer to it, but that's kind of what I see going on.
I completely agree with that. We're going to talk about a couple of stories that you have written recently. One story... The first story that we're going to speak about, it's called, you've been following this for a couple of years, this story, the latest entries to this story were done in early December, right, December 8th, and what we're going to talk about is the story Tracking the Bloody Footprints in the House of Death part.
Right, yeah.
And we're talking about Ciudad Juarez, and this is right across the border from El Paso, Texas, correct?
Correct.
And... we up here in Canada, we don't hear about Ciudad Juarez at all. We have heard about the prostitution story. There have been about 300 prostitutes that have been murdered down there mysteriously.
Yeah, well, they're actually not all prostitutes. That's a whole other.
That's a whole other game.
A lot of them are just school kids.
That's the only story, and that runs over AP, and our papers picked that up. But I was wondering if you could just walk my listeners through. A brief history of the House of Death in Ciudad Juarez and how you came upon this story and how it evolved with you.
Well, yeah, and actually we've written probably about 28 stories on this now, starting about 2 years ago is when we first started covering the series you referred to was done after we got a hold of some additional documents that really day by day, even in some cases hour by hour, outlined what happened. But essentially, you know, sources came forward to tell us about these murders that were happening in Juarez, which is literally a spitting distance across a freeway from El Paso. It's an area of, together of close to 2 million people, you know, 800,000 in El Paso or so. But anyway,
that's big. It's a big city.
Yeah, that's what I say. It's really a bigger area than people would imagine. They think a sleepy little border town, but it's actually a pretty big city. And just across the border, I mean, combined, and in Juarez, in a neighborhood that essentially, you know, for Juarez, looks like a middle-class neighborhood. I mean, you wouldn't stand out in any particular way. You know, there was a house where they, a group of narco thugs were actually tied into the Vicente Carrillo Fuentes organization, which is a huge narco-trafficking syndicate organization that operates out of Mexico, in that part of Mexico. We're taking folks and torturing them to get information, basically to figure out, you know, where they were hiding drugs or if they had crossed them and tried to bring drugs through that corridor. And in some cases, innocent people were on a stake and murdering them. And this went on from August 2003 to about January 2004. About a dozen people were done in this way.
And this is just a regular house. I mean, it's the house next door.
Yeah, I mean, literally. I mean, and the thing is, this house, the reason this story became significant was this goes on a lot. I mean, I shouldn't say a lot. This wouldn't be the only example of this kind of thing going on in the drug war along the border. And so this was kind of a portal into that world, if you will. I mean, it was a glimpse of, you know, like this rarely happens that this kind of thing surfaces into the mainstream world, if you will, for people to look at. And what was happening, what was unique about this, and tragic and rather disgusting, is that there was a U.S.-paid government informant who had penetrated the narco-trafficking ring that was behind these murders. And the U.S. government agents that were handling this guy, basically who he was reporting to and they were dealing with day to day, knew about these murders and were essentially letting them occur.
They knew that the murders were happening and they weren't stopping them.
Yeah, after the first, not only did they know that, they knew their informant was participating in them.
Jeez.
After the first murder, he came back and told them about it. And they let it continue for another, you know, 9-10 months. Well, an additional 11 people. So there were not, you know, even if you would argue the first murder they couldn't have prevented, which actually, that's even questionable. The rest of the murders could have been prevented, possibly.
And
let this guy go back in and continue to participate and help set up these murders at this house of death.
And it wasn't just murder. First of all, they murdered him, but they tortured him.
Oh, yeah.
They tortured
him. Yeah, it was things like, yeah, it was torture, the idea that you wanted to get information out of them. A number of them were other, you know, narco dealers or traffickers or smugglers or mules who made the mistake of, you know, crossing this territory, or had a big load that this group wanted to steal. But at least one of them appears, from what I've been able to figure out, just a kid who happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time that got kidnapped in El Paso and brought to the house of death and ended up murdered. But nobody seemed to care about this, and it kind of all came to a head in January of 2004. When these narco thugs, and you got to understand, the other part of this was this group was not only, you know, street level drug dealers, if you will, and narco organization lieutenants and so forth. It was Mexican cops involved. They were actually on the payroll of the narco trafficking organization down there. And the informant that the U.S. government was running was a former Mexican cop. So there's this kind of marriage of law enforcement in the drug world, it was like almost the perfect storm in that sense, because then the U.S. federal agents also became complicit in these murders. So you had Mexican law enforcement, U.S. law enforcement, and the narco world all converging, and nobody was stopping these murders. They were all, in a way, complicit in them.
On the U.S. side, what agency are we talking about? That
this was, at the time, this was Immigration and Customs Enforcement, which is part of Homeland Security. Now, DEA was involved in this operation, running the same informant, trying to go after this narco-trafficking ring. But this informant double-crossed them and tried to run a load across the border. They deactivated him and washed their hands of him at that point. This was like in June, before the first murder, in June of 2003. But ICE, the Immigration Customs Enforcement, it's called ICE, continued to run the guy. And 2 months later, he did the first murder, and then he continued. They could have shut this case down. They had the major guy they were targeting, a guy named Santillan, was basically implicated. They had done a sting operation in March of 2003. Now, Santillan was still in Mexico, but they had the goods to indict him then. But they didn't want to work with the Mexican feds, the Mexican government, to set up a sting, because then the Mexican government would have got Santillan, and then the U.S. law enforcers would not have gotten credit for the bust. You got to remember, this is all about, you know, at least in sources I'm dealing with, they're telling me it's all about people advancing their careers, getting case stats. I mean, that's the pretense of the drug war.
Getting the big bust.
Well, if you get the big bust, you get more money for your operations, your career looks better. If you're a prosecutor, I mean, they wanted a death sentence. The sickening part of this is after the first murder, right, and then he committed a few more, then they had a death sentence case against Santillan. So it almost appears as though they allowed the murders to happen so they could prosecute the guy for murder, get a death sentence case. So politically, you had the juice to get, you know, as a prosecutor, you would look, you know, good in the political system, and that's good for your career.
Is that possible?
That's what happened. essentially, that is what happened.
Incredible. So they just let the deaths keep going. So, I mean, it becomes a mass murderer.
Well, see, what happened in January of 2004, what brought it to a head, and there were three more people were brought to the House of Death, tortured and murdered. One of them gave up an address to a supposed stash house. Well, it just happened either by accident or on purpose. We really don't know. It happened to be the address of a DEA agent working in Juarez undercover. So the narco traffickers, including these Mexican cops, you know, set up a surveillance on the house and actually tried to pull over this DEA agent and his family, you know, little kid, and his wife and his the agent. Well, he had the common sense to not get out of the car, but if it had gone the wrong way that day, that agent and his family would have been at the House of Death dead.
Well, and the same guy that pulled him over, didn't that guy shoot somebody in the face?
2 days later.
2 days later, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So he could have been shot in the face, too.
However they did it, they would have done it. But they didn't know at the time this guy was DEA. The reason they found out is because the U.S. government informant was able to tell them. So, and then another couple DEA agents showed up, and they managed to get the guy out of there, and they had to evacuate all the DEA agents from Juarez. So needless to say, DEA was completely pissed off at ICE after this incident. And they at that point, the operation had to come to an end. And the person I was dealing with, Sandalio Gonzalez, who was the head of DEA in El Paso, or one of the people I was dealing with, he started to discover all this because, you know, after the fact, they had an investigation, and then he started seeing that ICE was stonewalling. They wouldn't let the informant, you know, they wouldn't give him access, the DEA access to the informant to debrief him. They were trying to get Loya, the guy that shot the guy in the face 2 days later, the Mexican cop, trying to get him picked up because he would have been key to, you know, explaining all this. But there was all this stonewalling going on the part of a U.S. prosecutor in El Paso that was working with ICE in this case, that Loya got away. To this day, he vanished. And the informant, you know, really, it was really too late by the time they got to him to get the information they needed. So anyway, this DEA chief in El Paso wrote a letter to ICE and to the U.S. attorney in San Antonio, who would be the boss of the U.S. of the assistant U.S. attorney in El Paso that was participating in this stonewalling and cover-up. You see, they didn't want it coming out. They had a bunch of memos and documents. They didn't want it coming out that they had let this informant run loose and murder people for a better part of a year. So they're trying to cover that up. After the letter was written to the U.S. attorney, instead of investigating it, the U.S. attorney went to his people up in the Department of Justice, including the head of the DEA, and screamed bloody murder, saying, you know, this letter is horrible. It creates discoverable evidence. It could damage the case. No lie. So they went back at Sandalio and retaliated against him, basically threatened to fire him and made his life miserable, ordered him to shut his mouth and not, you know, do anything.
So, I mean, so they do this stuff, and then they start covering it up, and it starts going past just the agencies that were involved. We were talking about the Department of Justice
now.
Well,
this went all the way up. Later it came out as we followed the story. We discovered that Tandy, the head of DEA, had personal knowledge of the situation, you know, had briefed the U.S. attorney or general prior to, you know, Gonzalez wrote this letter in February 2004. At that point, all the murders had occurred, you know, the 12 at the house and the two additional ones, like at least 14 that we know of. But we're not certain exactly how early they knew about all this. I mean, you would think that they knew about it from the first murder, and we know for a fact that the ICE agents knew, and by extension, the prosecutor in El Paso working the case would have known. But did she tell, how, you know, when did the rest of the chain find out about this? Well, that's why there needs to be an independent investigation. What did they know? When did they know it? But we know that it eventually, yeah, went as high as the U.S. Attorney General was aware that this was going on. And you got to remember, after that whole mess, this is February, sometime in late spring, early summer, this informant, who was then put under cover and hidden out so he wouldn't get whacked, managed to get back up to El Paso and set up a drug deal. But instead of going to pick the money up, he was supposed to pick some money up, and there was some kind of deal going down. He sent an acquaintance of his because, you know, he's a cagey guy. Well, it was a setup, and the guy he sent was some 25-year-old kid who had, you know, was a father and so forth. Goes to this Whataburger, just a fast food restaurant in El Paso, to do the money drop, and somebody comes up and pops him in the head with a couple bullets, kills the guy on the spot.
Wow.
So there was an additional murder that the informant was actually responsible for after all of this. So the cover-up that continued was, you know, contributes to this additional, you know, death and carnage. This is just, you know, and it's just frustrating to see. To this day, I mean, it continues. There's really been no mainstream media coverage of this case. I mean, there was up until the point that the cover-up started. But since then, no one's followed up on, well, you know, who's responsible for letting this happen? I mean, and how can we prevent it from happening again?
All right. You're listening to The Friday Morning After. I'm Joe Broadhurst at CKUT. It is 7:39, and I am speaking with Bill Conroy. He's with the Narco News. He's an investigative reporter down in Texas, and we are speaking about a story that he wrote. It's called The House of Death, and we're talking about murder and cover-up which involves government agencies, the War on Drugs, Drug Enforcement Agency, and Immigration and Customs. And so at this point, there's been no investigation. There's just been the cover-up, and it looks like Tandy – is Tandy still there?
Yeah. She's still at the top. Frankly, at this point, there's not much – hope that I see that, you know, that other than at least it's out on the internet, and I mean, where there's a couple hundred pages of FOIA documents on this. I mean, the story I'm telling you isn't really, it's all documented, and nobody has been held responsible for this, you know, in any administrative or even legal way, other than the fact that the whistleblower essentially, you know, was forced to retire early, and so it was the person kind of blowing the cover on the cover-up that paid the price. And that's unfortunately typical, and I think your listeners looking down what's happening in the States here, this has just been a pattern repeated over and over and over. It's eventually got to come to an end, because you can only cover up things so long before it all blows up in your face. And unfortunately, I think my phone is buzzing here. I'm going to switch phones. Okay.
Okay. Well, we're speaking with Bill Conroy. He's from Narco News, we are discussing cover-up and corruption in the Drug Enforcement Agency and Immigration and Customs down in the States. What happens here is these people, there's a lot of competition between these agencies, and they will do anything to get the big bust. And anything involves letting murders happen, doing anything. And if they can get a bigger bust by letting somebody kill 10 people or instead of one person and make a big show out of it, it looks great for their agency. And when they go at the end of the fiscal year and ask for money, they ask for more money, and they say, look at this big, we caught this mass murderer, check this out. Are you there, Bill?
Yeah, I was just going to say, just to kind of put it in perspective, or at least my perspective, not everybody in these agencies is like this. This is pretty much like the human race. I mean,
there's a certain portion of people that are bad. That's just all there is to it.
Yeah, and it's, I think of it like Shakespeare and Macbeth. I mean, there's just a lot of, weak human characters out there who succumb to, self-interest and greed.
But also with the cover-up, there could be good people that are involved in the cover-up, but they have really no power to do anything. I mean,
exactly.
And that's once the cover-up starts rolling, all of a sudden, people, and then you have the whistleblowers like Sandy Gonzalez, who was with the DEA down in El Paso, and then the whistleblowers end up getting the hammer comes down on the whistleblowers.
Yeah, and that's basically what happens, and you're right, it's people that they have families and they have kids, and they go, well, I know if I speak up about this or I take a stand on this, I'm gonna lose my job, and that means I can't send my kids to college, and it's all the usual stuff that comes up. So there is that element. So it only takes a few people. It isn't a massive conspiracy, really. It's just understanding human motivation and putting people in positions where that they have no choice.
Exactly.
Some people are very good at that, and unfortunately, people in the U.S. government, some people are very good at that, and they have unlimited resources to play this game. I mean, they have unlimited resources and access to lawyers and money and guns. So you're really fighting an uphill battle if you stand up to this stuff, unless it's done on a mass scale, unless you got thousands and millions of people stand up and say this is enough. Short of that, they isolate you and pretty much control you.
Yeah, and you don't want the Department of Justice coming down on you.
No.
We don't have very much time left. We got about 5 minutes, and I want to talk about this other story, a leaked memo. Can you? The story is called "Leaked Memo: Corrupt DEA Agents in Colombia Help Narcos and Paramilitaries." Can you give us a background on that one?
Yeah. Well, essentially, that story is just starting to unfold. It did get picked up by the mainstream press here down in the States, and I assume got picked up there as well, and definitely in the Latin America. But the a U.S. prosecutor, attorney, essentially government attorney on the wiretap unit, wrote this memo at the end of 2004, essentially alleging that DEA agents in Bogota were involved in complicit with narco traffickers down there, money laundering and murdering informants and a range of pretty serious corruption. And again, it's a case where he wrote this memo. Some of the DEA agents that were bringing this information forward, they were Florida DEA agents who ran across this after they tried to report it. They got retaliated against. And then the investigation into the corruption itself, according to the memo, was whitewashed. And so this memo came through. Narco News got leaked to Narco News and surfaces, early January was when we put it up.
And this is called the Kent memo?
Yeah, Thomas Kent was the attorney. He's now an assistant U.S. attorney in Nashville, but he's the guy that wrote the memo. And it's, includes allegations that the Bogota agents, some of the, not all of them, but there's a group of them, were involved in laundering money for the right-wing paramilitaries down there, that they were, you know, essentially, you know, passing information on to narco traffickers, DEA information that would be useful in helping them avoid problems with law enforcement and so forth. Where it stands right now is the DEA initially issued a statement saying, we take these charges very seriously, we're going to look into them. And 9 days later, they issued another statement saying, well, we've already looked into them and determined there's nothing to them. Well, we got another story coming out in the next few days that will advance it some more. And the El Nuevo Herald, which is the Miami Herald Spanish edition, has been covering it. They did another story about 3-4 days ago, actually advanced a good story, looking at one aspect of these allegations and discovering that it's pretty wrapped up into the politics of Colombia as well. That there's some, basically they were able to figure out who one of the informants was that was mentioned in this memo. So it's a complicated story, but you know, after you get all the players, the reason it's complicated is a lot of names are hidden, or you only get pieces of the puzzle. And what we're trying to do is work it out, even if it takes some time, to get as much of that puzzle together. And then once it's all on the table, it tends to become a lot simpler. It does appear that this is another case of serious charges of corruption are made, and instead of investigating these and trying to correct them, the reaction of the leadership is to cover them up and try to put them in a closet so nobody sees them.
And does that cover up? Do you think that goes all the way up to DHS and to the top levels of DHS?
Well, on this one, I don't know at this point. Clearly, this went, the allegations are that it went to the upper levels of DEA, and then the Department of Justice has a watchdog branch called the Office of Inspector General, that somewhere along the line, those agencies were influenced to whitewash the investigation in this corruption. It's difficult to say, and that's the other thing, is there's a trying to pin responsibility on someone. These leaderships change, these scandals occur over the course of years, and everyone passes the buck. It didn't happen on my watch or what have you. So it's really almost a systemic cancer, and who do you blame cancer on? Ultimately, I think you blame it on, unfortunately, you got to blame it on the American people for not really taking control of their government and making sure that this stuff, people's feet get held to the fire while they're in office, even when they're out of office, and that the system gets corrected. But it's just a cancer, and it's actually metastasizing inside the bureaucracy of this country.
And like we said before, this isn't something that is across the board, but when you're talking about as much money, how much money is the budget for the war on terror? Do you know?
Well, no, I'd have to look it up like anyone else, but suffice it to say,
we're talking billions.
They're spilling $1.5 billion on Plan Colombia alone. So, yeah, you're talking billions of dollars and across multiple agencies. You have programs in the schools, you have, that are benign to programs that are, building prisons. And I mean, that's just it. You're right. It's a huge industry.
Yeah.
And there's not a lot of incentive to collapse an industry that has run amok because there's too many people that are making a livelihood off it.
You don't want to make anything look bad. You don't want to make the war on drugs look bad. So even if it's, 2% of the people, the other 98% don't want that to get out, because then, it looks bad for the whole agent, all these agencies that are doing
it. Yeah, and I think it's painted that way because that, makes sense about the way human motivation works. But in reality, crime is going to exist. So the war on drugs is not necessary to, getting rid of the war on drugs is not going to get rid of crime. So you're always going to, you're just going to have that. At least that's my belief, unless we all suddenly, become enlightened beings overnight, which, I haven't seen any sign of in the last few centuries of human history. But you don't have to make matters worse by introducing a pretense that it really is not ever, that actually adds fuel to the fire. And I think that's part of what that is a big part of what the problem is. It really needs to be dealt with, with you know, a crook is a crook is a crook. I don't care if he has a badge on or if he's, you know, holding a gun to someone's head, extorting money out of them. I mean, that's the problem, not dealing with, you know, somebody growing a plant in their backyard. I mean, you know,
exactly.
There's a difference to me.
All right. Well, we're gonna have to leave it there, Bill. I'm sorry, but it's been great talking to you this morning. I've been speaking with Bill Conroy, and he's an investigative reporter down in the United States. You can visit Narco News and narconews.com, narconews.com, and almost all of your stories from the last 2 years have been posted there, right?
Yeah. You can get access to all the stories. We have about 270 co-publishers, in other words, writers who contribute to the site, plus a kind of a core staff that's based in areas in Latin America, in South America, and Mexico. And you can get access to all those stories. Just go in and explore the site. It's pretty easy to navigate, and you can actually write for the site. If they explain how, if you want to become a contributor.
So if you have something to say about or if maybe you know something that's going on in Canada and the U.S. on dealing with those kind of things, please visit that site. Visit the site anyways, just because it's interesting. And we're talking about people that are writing stuff, writing truth. And it's really important that people understand the truth. So thank you very much, Mr. Conroy. And I hope you have a good weekend. And I hope we speak with you again soon.
Yeah, well, I appreciate it, and take care, and have a good day out there, okay?
I will. We're getting freezing rain, so we're going to try.
Okay.
See you later.
Drive careful.
You too.